The great philosopher Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." Looking back only results in learning for people who have that time to think, and many of us are so busy with day-to-day demands that we rarely have time to reflect. And that's why we started What I Wish I Knew. It's for those moments when you realize that just a bit of insight might have come in handy if you had it in advance. I'm Mike Irwin.
And I'm Simon Dorr. So we talk with people from all walks of life, from startup entrepreneurs to Fortune 500 CEOs, professional athletes to weekend warriors, from artists and to designers to even engineers who became designers, from those who dream to those who dream then actually do. They all have three things in common. None are perfect, all are humble, and each have truly incredible learnings. In What I Wish I Knew, they share these lessons with you.
Join us at whatiwishinewshow.com. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And please share and subscribe to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw. Welcome to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw. We're excited today because we're joined by Bernie Schroeder, who has an incredible background. Bernie is an author. He's written several books, including Brands and Bullshit, which I recommend you read, Fail Fast or Win Big, Simply Brilliant, and his latest is Startup Culture Mindset. And so I encourage everyone to kind of take a look at his books. But he's also an accomplished speaker and runs the circuit. He's been on many TEDx events as well. He's an entrepreneur, which is, you know, why he's joining us today, where he turned a tiny marketing agency into a global powerhouse with more than $1 billion in billings and thousands of employees. But it might be that the thing that I admire most about Bernie is that he is an entrepreneur teacher. He's created an entrepreneur factory at San Diego State University, and he goes on every year in teaching entrepreneurs around the world. And so, Bernie, welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
Thanks for having me today.
So tell us, Bernie, like, how did you get here? I know you were born in Austria, but how did you end up landing in this place and then deciding to do what you do now?
I think, you know, for the people that are listening to this, I think you have to follow your heart. Born in Europe, but grew up in a little bit in New York and then mostly Detroit. And my heart was speaking to me in Detroit as I finally figured out what I was going to do. And it said I could not do my craft in Detroit. And I wanted to go where the challenge was greater. I wanted to go to New York. I wanted to go to San Francisco. And I think you have to follow your heart. You'll hear it. And instead of quieting it, follow it. And I can tell you that simple move, that mental move, one stop saying, I'm going to go to New York and see how good I am. You know, that led to a great assignment with Mercedes in New York, which then led to a chance meeting with an executive from Apple. And in that relative two-year time period, from the time I made that decision, I was in San Francisco.
And Bernie,
and then that just stonewalled to everything else.
And Bernie, just in terms of that move, just for the clarity here, were you in Detroit in the car world and you just transplanted and looked at the opportunity with Mercedes, or was it something else?
I was with an agency in Detroit, and they had a variety of work, but Detroit is dominated by the automotives. There's no agency that exists there that has of any consequence that doesn't do work with the car companies. But I had done some work with Kellogg's. I had done some work with American Express and Blue Cross. But on a chance meeting led me to meet an executive from Mercedes, and I think they liked my background. I had done work with all the car companies in Detroit, and I also was from Europe. I still fluently spoke the language. And so they felt I was one of them. I honestly believe that. And they actually lured me to join the agency that I joined in New York.
So in that sense, I mean, you grew up, you see this, you know, this opportunity. Was it clear that marketing was it, that, you know, the direction you wanted to take was obvious to you at that stage?
No. When I had gone to a private school in Detroit, nothing super high end, just a good Catholic school. My parents put all of us through private school, which was amazing. When I came out of school, I had no clue what I wanted to do, and it was very frustrating for me. I tried a year at Michigan, and I failed horribly. Like, like mentally. I just hated it. I hated the business program. I hated accounting. I hated finance. And the reason was I couldn't connect the dots to my future. I had no mentors, so I couldn't connect the dots to say, what is this college degree going to get me when I don't know what I want to do? So I spent some time doing some other things. And when I went back to college, I thought I was going to go down a management path, Michael, to be honest with you. And I only took one or two marketing classes in my undergraduate degree, and I hated them both, to be honest. And so when I graduated, or was getting ready to graduate, like most things, I had been building a small network as I was moving through college. And because I know I'm graduating at the age of 28 and I'm behind. So I was building my network, and I had two people come forward and recommend me for two different types of jobs before I even graduated. I took the one that appeared to be the most future forward. Matter of fact, that's what I tell most students today. If you have a choice between two industry opportunities, take the one that's going forward. In other words, if you want to work with a car company today, don't work with GM, work with Tesla. You know, go with the future, wherever the future is going for that brand. And so I took this job at this company, and I knew it was going to be a marketing / project management position. To be honest, I accepted and signed the offer letter and had no clue what I was going to do. And it was only after I got into the position where I was initially doing project management, where I started to make little tiny recommendations on how we could do something in a project better. And we were working with GM at the time. And I was like nobody on the team, but I would make these little suggestions. Everybody would kind of look at me and go, huh, that's interesting. That's smart. And so without realizing it, I was starting to lean in to marketing. And within about a year of working there, I realized I was a better marketer than I was a project manager. And I just started, setting myself up for promotions in the marketing side of the agency versus project management.
That's fascinating. So you talked earlier about go with your heart. I got a true sense here. You're quite a determined your personality, though, because you talked about moving and then weren't sure, but then you went into marketing. Where does that drive come from? Is that a practiced? Is that inherent in you? Is that, if people are listening to this podcast, what elements or skill set are they needing to practice or bring?
I think I was always a little bit restless as a child, but I think the drive, it's not a drive, Simon, as much as it is this feeling of leaving something undone. I knew that in my life, I didn't want to leave anything undone. I had competed in ice hockey and tennis. I competed hard, but I think it was an event that occurred when I was 19, when a very young aunt of mine was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I went and sat with her for 3 hours one day, completely bewildered. Like, what do you say to someone who's going to die in 3 weeks, right? And I remember her having the kindness to kind of relate to me the things she missed out on her life. Like, she died at the age of 36. And sitting there on her bed, listening to her talk about, and not she wasn't angry. She was past it. She'd already accepted it, but she was just saying, hey, my last words of advice to someone like you, because if I'm reading you correctly, is, try to live your life without regrets. Here are about 15 of mine. And I thought she was the perfect person, super successful, this and that. All of a sudden, she starts laying out all these regrets. And I was like, holy cow. And I remember walking out of there, knowing I would never see her alive again, and saying to myself as I sat in my car, no matter what I do, I will not have a freaking regret.
Wow.
Yeah, very powerful.
That is. So as you look at that as sort of motivation, so you go into the car industry, how did you end up landing at this tiny agency that you then built into a monster?
That was all part of being curious. Mike, it's a funny thing, and I think, Simon, you're the same way. When you work for someone and you decide you want to be good, right? And I don't mean just a good employee. I mean good. I mean, you could take that anywhere, right? You decide to lean in and make yourself an expert, right? So it's no longer about working hard. It's making yourself an expert within the craft that you choose, right? It's a big difference. Like a lot of people think they're just working. If they're just working, they're putting in time. I decided early on that I was going to lean in hard to marketing. And I worked crazy hours, not on work. I would come in on the weekends, or I would stay late only to play with using the analytic package. I would play learning how to write code so I could do extracts out of the database. All of it was to make me better at everything that I did, right? And so once you get to that level, like I thought I was at that level in Detroit. When I went to New York and ran Mercedes North American Marketing, which was a big deal, and I was able to do it well, it was almost this realization, like, why am I working for these guys at the agency that have no freaking clue what I'm doing at Mercedes? Mercedes people love me. Like, if I left right now, they would hire me in a heartbeat. So I started this thought process in my head. If I'm already good at marketing, why would I do it for anyone else as an employee? Why wouldn't I just find some other people like me and build an agency? Like, if I'm going to do marketing for the rest of my life, why would I do it as an employee? Because I can do marketing for the rest of my life. I could start an agency, I could fail, and then I could go do marketing. I mean, I could continue to do marketing. And once I crossed that bridge in my mind that I was good enough, that clients loved me, and I was, you know, sharp enough to recognize talent, it took me to New York. I met a guy on a plane from Apple in a 5-hour conversation. We'd struck up such a strong relationship. I followed up with him at the end. 2 months later, I had a 2-year consulting gig with Apple as a senior consultant to their senior VP of marketing. And I didn't use that to get to Apple. Apple was in serious trouble at the time, and it was like insanity. They were a year away from bankruptcy. They had young kids they hired because they couldn't really afford pros. Their marketing was way behind anything you would see in consumer. I only used that 2-year contract to get to Silicon Valley because I had tried to start an agency in New York. I went to some other experts that I thought were sharp. They were all afraid to leave their shops. And I was like, wow, there's too much fear in New York. It's more about money and career than about destiny and life. And so I was like, where is the edge of that? And I was like convinced it was in Silicon Valley. So I had never been to California before, but I moved to California.
But what made you attracted to Apple if you said you weren't sure about what it was doing? And what
it was just, Simon, it was just an opportunity. It was like a train that was going west. I met that guy. He was explaining what they were doing. It was like kindergarten stuff compared to the sophisticated marketing I was doing. But his heart and his passion, this guy's 25 years old. He's a director of marketing at Apple with a $60 million budget. And he's 25. I'm sitting there at the time, I think I was 31 or 32. And I'm thinking, they're letting punks, you know, run marketing at Apple. Like, how is this possible? But he was such a smart, good guy. And I was like, if this is the tone and the demeanor, and this is the level of risk taking that's at Apple, then A, I'm going to go work there, and I'm going to use that as a platform to find the guys I'm looking for. And within 6 months of moving out there, I found them.
Wow. So, Bernie, you talked about something really important, and that is ownership. And I think there's a distinction that you make as an entrepreneur, and this is something I used to tell people that I would work with. I'd say, look, you don't work for the company. You don't work for me. You work for you. Everything you do, you work for you. Because what that means then is when you think about, well, I'm going to work, it's actually, yeah, you're going to work, but you can be working on you as well and getting better. So what's your, if you talk to a 22-year-old or a 24-year-old today, what do you wish they knew about their career, even if they're not yet sure what direction to take?
You know, that's a great question because, you know, when I started my career, I had no clue. I had no clue about how a company worked. I had no clue about office politics. I had no clue about how do you rise in a company. And so it took me 4 or 5 years to figure out that I needed to become valuable. And the value didn't come from working for someone. It came from making myself more valuable because then the company felt I was more valuable, right? I could do more for them. But in essence, I'm really investing in myself. So when I talk to the 21 and the 22-year-olds today, that's exactly what I tell them. I go, You know, first of all, hire your company. Don't take any job. Do your research and your homework. And then when you hire your company, you go, I want to go work for Kashi. I want to go work for Costco. Then look at who you might work for. Look at their LinkedIn profile. Look at their background. You know, look at who this person is and what's going on and say, is this the kind of person that can mentor me? Do they have a skill set that I want? Can I be the remora to that chart, right? And to be that methodical, I mean, and then so now when you enter the company, you're more in line with, I don't want to be a project coordinator or a marketing coordinator. I want to be a CMO, or I want to start an agency someday. So that's what I'm trying to set these 21, 22 year olds up, is to say, after 5 or 6 years, not what is your destiny, what do you see yourself doing, but how much of an expert do you want to become so that you have choices? You can choose to stay with a company, you can choose to go to another company, or you can choose to create a company. And in order to do that, you have to become an expert. You don't get those choices unless you become an expert. And so that's my advice, is don't get so hung up on the company and the politics and this. Learn your craft so well that you're in the top 1 or 2%, and always be learning and training yourself for what's next. Don't worry about, don't angst about a promotion, don't angst about a raise. You know, those will come. You have to believe in yourself, right, is what I tell these kids. And I'm doing it with my kids, right? I've got a 22-year-old, I've got a 26-year-old, and I've got a 29-year-old. And I told them all the same thing. You know, oh, they only offered me this much, but you'll be able to do this and this and this. And they see it now. They didn't see it at the beginning. And so often I wonder, especially for the 22-year-olds that are graduating today, if they don't have this kind of distant mindset and a good mentor and maybe some good advisors, they probably spend 3 to 5 years wasting time. They'll learn something, but they're not moving in a direction they want to move, because they never thought they could direct it. They thought that the direction comes from your manager and your manager promoting you. And so you have to serve time until you get promoted, and then you have other opportunities. And you have to flip that upside down and say, I'm as valuable as the CEO, so what's my value going to be? It's funny, sometimes I'm interviewing a student and they'll say, I'll say, what's your experience as I try to help them get a job? And they go, well, you know, I was just a cashier at X, or I was just a waiter at Y. And I go, so if I remove you from the business, what happens to the business? And they go, well, there is no business. And I go, great. So you're the face of the brand. So you need to portray yourself as understanding that you're the face of the brand. So now, what does someone who understands the face of the brand, how do they present themselves as the value that they drove from being either a cashier or a customer service person? Then they see it. They're like, okay, I get it now.
Bernie, just a question again on that then. So, you know, we've all have young kids similar ages, and the canvas seems to be different from my lens. I don't know if you agree, just in terms of the what I see in characters and you know, the potential churn rate of jobs and people in the younger groups wanting to move on and upwards fast. What would you say the key kind of anchor points that they should be thinking about? You talked about expertise, but are you saying specialism, or kind of being agnostic and saying, look, if you're a marketer, get to know more on the commercial side, if you're, you know, etc. How would you grasp that?
I think early in your career, I think you have to be a specialist. You know, for me, it was pushing myself into the database marketing side of the first agency I was with. Once I became kind of more of a database marketing expert, then that started opening up other doors to me. Because there was only one in the agency and it was me. I self-made myself the database marketing expert. I've got a daughter at Patagonia who I said, you need to become the social media czar as it relates to e-commerce at Patagonia, once I understood the lay of how Patagonia was organized. And so she took extra classes in e-commerce, social media, went and interviewed entrepreneurs that use social media to drive revenue. You know, here she is now, she's going in her third year at Patagonia. She is responsible for social media e-commerce when that's not what she was hired in to do. You know, and it's funny, unfortunately, I mean, Santa Barbara is where she is in Ventura up there in Patagonia. I thought that part of the deal of supporting her up there was just to get free Patagonia gear, which, by the way, we've gotten a shitload of Patagonia gear. But she's in love with it. And it's such a cult inside Patagonia in a good way. Like, it takes a long time to get hired into Patagonia. Like, she served 18 months as an intern before she got a full-time offer. And so I think she's there until she decides to quit, but they keep promoting her, right? My other two children, they're going on their fifth and seventh year in their companies because they made themselves experts in a certain way, and the culture hasn't turned against them. Like, if you say, what would make a young person job hop? It's not necessarily the money, and maybe the opportunity, maybe not. It's the culture. This is a culture generation like I've never seen before. If they don't feel they belong, if they don't feel they get along with other people, if they don't feel there's opportunities for them, regardless of whether there is or not, they're out. And so they've done the pay it forward thing, where I've told them, look, put in the effort, put in the old school effort and bring it, but bring it with an area of expertise, right? And they've done that. They've all three focused in on an area of marketing to become really good at. And so, you know, I'll be honest with you, I don't think every situation is perfect for all three of them. And a couple times I thought they would leave the situation that they were in because of a culture issue, but they stayed. And they seem to be doing fine. I mean, if you told me, you know, your kids are going to graduate college, they're going to get jobs, they're going to stay in those jobs 5-6 years, I'd be like, no. These millennials and Gen Zs, like 2 years max, maybe three, and they're going to hop. But what I've learned in watching them, it's the culture that's making them feel good about what they're doing. It's not necessarily the money. The money's there, and it's somewhat of a driver, Simon, but it's not the driver.
So I get the sense of what you just described, Bernie, that your family have done so well, and you talked about this specialism, yeah, and getting the expertise. So it's a kind of a win-win, is that correct? So you're doing stuff that's valuable, they're being valued for it, and growing. So why would you consider moving too, alongside the cultural piece, of course?
Well, the only reason you would move, ultimately, even if you were in a great environment, is to challenge yourself. You know, that's one reason. There's, you know, it's funny. The years creep up on you very quickly. You know, like, it just seems like, you know, my son, you know, took his second or third job, you know, yesterday. And now he's going into his eighth year in marketing, right? And I never thought one, he'd be a marketer. Two, I never thought he'd be good at it. But it turns out his calmness, Simon, in a sea of chaos, because you know what marketing looks like, especially on the agency side. He has this calm demeanor that clients think he's just super confident. His agency management think he's just amazing, because he's the one who stays calm when teams are blowing up, when deadlines are missed. And I never saw that in him. And his ability to be calm is making him super successful. I'm not telling you that he's not learning his craft, but in the sea of chaos, his ability to stay calm calms everybody else down, calms the client down. And now after 5, 6, 7 years, he's learned how to be honest too. So now he has honest conversations with clients, and that's very tough to do. But he has this calm confidence where he says to the client, yeah, we can't do that in 2 weeks. And the client yells at him, and he's like, I'll tell you why we can't. And he goes, and if you try to force us to do it, it's going to blow up. So if you want it to blow up and you want to push us toward blowing it up, tell me to do it, we'll blow it up. And then the clients, because he does it in a calm manner, like, he's not a type A account person. You know, type A account person would be in the client's face going, this is bullshit and blah, 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 blah. He doesn't do that. He just says, look, we could do that. Here's what's going to happen. Or I could go back to my team, move some things around, and get it done in 3 weeks, and it'll be done right. Which would you prefer? And the way he does it, I never saw it.
Fantastic. So talk a little bit about, I mean, you know, you... took a, you know, somewhat of a similar track, and that you were working, you know, for an agency. How does someone make that transition from a challenging, good job with, you know, with something like that into saying, hey, I want to take the risk now. I'm ready for that risk to go off on my own, do something more entrepreneurial, either start something or join a startup. What are the telltale signs that you would say would indicate that the person is ready and that the opportunity is right?
You know, that's a great point, because timing is critical. You can't just say, well, I want to go out and start a shop. You have to have all the assets. You have to have all the skill and the experience first. I think when I was successful in New York, I knew that I didn't want to start a shop by myself. I knew that I was part of, I knew I was a musketeer, but I was one of a group of musketeers. And I'd always felt that. In all the team sports that I played early in my life, I loved being in a team environment. I saw the synergy of a good team. I saw the synergy of a good nucleus of people. And so when I convinced myself, well, here's the questions I asked myself, right, when in New York. Do you like marketing? Freaking love marketing. Okay. Will you be doing marketing for the rest of your life? Pretty much. Okay, well, if you love marketing and you're going to do it for the rest of your life, then why would you do it for someone else? That was it. It was that simple. It was like, you're good enough. You have the client connections. You have the confidence. You have the skill set. You should build a shop, because the shops you've been in, all good, were not perfect the way you wanted them to be, didn't treat people the way you wanted to treat, didn't treat clients the way you wanted to treat. And so if you're going to do this anyway, might as well do it for yourself, because you're going to do it for another 20 years, and you can't do it for 20 years pissing and moaning about who you're working for. And these clients suck, and my boss is crazy, and blah, 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 blah. You're going to have those conversations, by the way, anyway, when you have your own job. Don't think it gets any better from that perspective. It really didn't. But then, you know, that it was that simple. And it was that simple again, Michael, after our company went public. And I was 2 years into it, and we hit 650, 700 million, and I was burned. I mean, I was like torched, burned. And I was like, okay, I didn't expect this to happen. I didn't expect this to go public. Now what? And I had no plan B. And for about 18 months, I kind of struggled. And my plan B, and there was no reason for me to leave. Right? It's just going to be more money, more options, more work. But I had gotten away from the work, and now I was becoming that quintessential senior partner manager that didn't really deal with clients anymore, but dealt with hundreds of people. And I didn't like that. I liked being in the kitchen. So I bailed. You know, that's when I left the agency and came down to San Diego, and I put myself at risk again by stepping into a turnaround situation by myself. And that was the way for me to rekindle my fire, was to say, I'm going to go to the client side. I know what needs to be done, because I've been on the agency side. No agency is going to be able to BS me. So I'm going to go be a COO, CMO, and I'm going to see if I can go fix broken companies. And that's what I ended up doing. And it was, I can't even tell you how reinvigorated I was once I stepped outside of this big company that we built and stepped back into more of a Navy SEAL environment where it was on me. And I love when it's on me. There's no hiding. I love the accountability. I loved, you know, that you live and die by the decisions you made. And I believe if you're going to be a great marketer, you have to have that confidence. You can't second guess yourself. Second guessing your work or your decision making, leads to group and consensus think, which usually leads to crap. And so I love being back out on point, reporting to just a CEO and saying, I will fix this.
That's fascinating. And Bernard, you talked as well about your learning when you went to the agency side of what you wanted to bring on your own. I guess there was a gap there somewhere. Can you explain to the listeners what gap you saw, and have you used that skill set since?
You know, identify exactly what you mean by a gap, Simon.
You talked about you knew you could set up an agency and bring to it, I guess, competencies and interaction that you never saw when you were part of other agencies.
I get it now. So when I'm in New York, the predominant amount of money I'm spending on a budget is advertising, right? I mean, it's ridiculous. It's like 150 out of the 200 is on advertising. And so I started hanging around. Remember, I grew up in a smaller agency in Detroit around database, you know, and data and surveys and customer loyalty and SAT and a little bit of promotion work for Kellogg's. And so when I got to New York, everybody was like, advertising is the hammer, use it. You know, and I was like, okay. It was the first time I was really exposed to like heavy, heavy advertising. But I'm hanging out with all these sharp people in New York that are doing outdoor. They're doing display. They're doing merchandising. They're doing point of sale. And as I'm watching this, I was very much into the idea that I needed to be a little bit of a futurist for my clients, because clients were paying you a lot of money to see over the horizon. They'd say, should we go this way? Should we go that way with the brand? So I spent a lot of time with analysts, Simon, probably more so than other marketers might choose to do, you know, reading the analyst reports from Forrester and IDC and Gartner and looking. I was very much into trends, you know, trying to plot dots. And my instinct in 1990 was screaming at me saying, advertising is not going to be the hammer. In some point in the future, it's not going to be the hammer. And I believe the hammer was going to be the multiple arrows that you fired. So rather than firing a cannon, you fired 10,000 arrows, you know, and that's how a brand would take market share. And so this whole concept, I was thinking about integrated marketing, Simon, before I knew what the word was. But once I got out to California following this theme, so I don't want to create any agency. I want to create a next generation integrated shop. I'm doing more research on integrated. How do you bring the disciplines together? You know, and so when I found these guys in Silicon Valley, they were leaning towards integrated as well. They had all come from bigger shops or the brands. And so it was kismet. We met at the same time kind of going, you know, I think integrated's going to win. And they were like, we think integrated's going to win. So are there any integrated agencies? No. So it's perfect positioning. We become the first integrated shop.
And building on that then, Bernie, as you look at that, because you created this massive success, if you had
never saw it coming, Michael.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, I mean, what were the ingredients of that? Were there things that you know, you talked about trend, you talked about, you know, pulling together integrated marketing. Are there anything you can take from that that says, I kind of feel like I need these three or four things, ingredients, if you will, that make you feel like this could be a good thing?
You know, I've always believed, I think I have a line from one of my books, the customer is not always right, but they're never wrong, right? Because they vote with their wallet. And as I was dealing with chief marketing officers and CEOs on the agency side, I could sense their frustration. They would say things to us like, how do I know my advertising is effective? And we were like, it is, you know? And I would go back to the agency going, shit, I don't know if it's effective. I know we're doing a ton of it, but if you tell me, you know, what are we actually measuring? Are we measuring every literal component of everything we're doing? And the answer was no. And so I was like, if we build something, it has to be to the benefit of the customer. So I put myself in the CMO or the senior VP of marketing's seat. And I said, if I were the CMO or the senior VP of marketing, I would want the best approach to the market. I wouldn't want just a single hammer. And so I said, well, if I was that person, what would I want? I said, you know, I think I'd want a little bit more of an integrated approach, not because if when you spoke integrated in 1990 and you were in a room of advertising professionals, you pretty much got urinated on. I mean, people were like, you're stupid. Like advertising is the dog and da, da, da. And you couldn't even have a conversation with a high level executive in an advertising agency. That they looked at you like you were from some other caste system that you were not worthy of speaking to anymore. But yet when you talk to the client side, you could hear their frustration. So this wasn't a gambit, Michael. This wasn't us going integrated, you know, like throwing a dart. We had all been listening to clients and to senior VPs and CMOs, and they were frustrated. They didn't like the agency model. They didn't like the 15% commission. we set ourselves up purposely like a law firm. In the first 4 years of our agency, we didn't touch media. We didn't touch it. We outsourced it. We might put the media plan together, but we tried to tell the executives that the business we were chasing at, we are not slaved to media. We'll do what is the right thing to do for your brand. And when they saw we didn't have a media component, they were like, dang, these guys are going to be maybe a little more honest and tell me what might work or should work than, hey, they're another media shop, so it's going to be advertising because that's how they make their money. We set ourselves up like a law firm. We build everything by the hour.
So fast forward a little bit, and I also want to talk about your books in a minute, but you do all this stuff. You build this massive agency, you go into turnaround situations, have an impact there, and then you decide that you want to start teaching entrepreneurs. Why did you do that?
I was at a company that I had fixed, and for the first time in my life, I was mailing it in. I literally was working 20 to 25 hours a week as a C-level executive, and I had never done that before in my life. I had fixed this company beautifully, and it took me about 15 months. And then in months 16, 17, 18, I just idled. I didn't do shit. I went for runs at lunchtime. Some days I didn't even go in. But I had put together such a strong team, I could skate. And I was skating, you know, for the first time in my life. I'd stayed too long, right? Usually I fix companies and I leave. On this one, I didn't know what I wanted to do next, so I was just kind of goofing off. And I think everybody knew it. No one seemed to care. So one day I woke up and I'm laying in bed and I don't want to go in at all. And so I walk into my home office, I type up a one sentence resignation letter on my computer. I drive to the building where the company is at. I walk into the CEO's office at like 8 o'clock in the morning and I put the letter on his desk. And he goes, "What's this?" I go, "I'm resigning." And I go, "Why are you resigning?" I go, "I was laying in bed today and I didn't want to get up and come to work." He goes, "I feel that way every day." And I was like, "But I can't do it." And he goes, "You can't leave." And I go, "No, I got a great team. You can run this without me. I'm out of here." And I didn't actually have a plan B. I volunteered at a horse ranch for a while. I hired a tennis pro to get my game back in shape. And it was during that time where I kind of looked back at my network. And there was one person I'd met years earlier who was a professor at State. And I just called him up out of the blue and I said, "Hey, I've always loved the feeling I've had when I walked on college campuses. Can I buy you lunch?" So I had lunch with him. He was a marketing professor in the business school. And I just asked him, you know, "What do you like about it? What do you hate about it?" Blah, blah, blah. And long story short, at the end of that lunch, I asked for a meeting, if he would set up a meeting with the dean. And he did. And I met with the dean and they weren't overly cordial. They were like, "Do you have a graduate degree?" I go, "No." And they knew who I was because of the agency. I was actually in their agency, was in their textbooks. But they did not go out of their way. They saw me as a midlife crisis refugee that was going to hide at a college campus. And so the meeting ended with no confirmation on anything. They were like, "Well, if you don't have a graduate degree, you can't work here." And I go, "Would you waive the requirement?" And they go, "No." Yeah. So the next day, I enrolled in the MBA program at State in Open University and went to the dean's office. She saw me. She's like, "What are you doing here?" I said, "How do you crash classes? Because if I need to have a graduate degree to teach here, I'm getting a freaking graduate degree." So I got my MBA in 1 year and started teaching marketing there.
Fabulous. I get the sense as well that that's typical of what you described in your early part of your career, that it's about determination.
It's determination, Simon, but it's also never becoming complacent. You know, like, you get good at marketing, you build a marketing agency, you go do turnarounds, what's next? You know, I'm not a good groundskeeper. I'm an architect. You know, if you gave me an estate, I would ruin it. If you told me to build an estate, it would be amazing. So I'm really, really good at building things and leaving. I learned that early on in my life. And it's why I love building brands, because if you had the right amount of money in the team, you could build brands amazingly fast if you lined everyone up on strategy. And I love that reinforcement. I love that kind of quickness to it. And I learned that I wasn't a good groundskeeper. I learned I wasn't good at maintenance. I mean, you heard me say earlier, you know, I started in project management, but I could see I could do it, but I didn't like it. Lots of little details, lots of meetings, you know, and I was like, man, it was, as soon as I saw what the marketing people did, I was like, I want to go over in that hallway. Cause that looks like a run and gun offense. And once I got there, I flourished. And once I flourished, I was like, my environment has to be run and gun. I cannot play, you know, an I formation, run three in the line offense. I mean, I'm throwing on every freaking down.
So Bernie, as you think about what you do today, and just for the benefit of the audience, he built this amazing entrepreneur factory at San Diego State, where he coaches, teaches, inspires, challenges, and instigates entrepreneurs all over campus every single year, and in the summers with entrepreneur groups from around the world. If someone thinks they might want to start their business, what do you wish that they knew at the front end?
You know, if wishes, you know, were horses or whatever that saying is, I think for some people, it's a wish. For the people that I coach and try to coach and try to give advice to, it's a do. You know, you need to be doing something that moves you to the path. You can't just wish it. And so I like when kids get dirty, you know, selling something on Etsy or eBay. I like when they go work for an entrepreneur and learn the craft. I like when they're doing something, you know. And so that's it. I mean, you know, the Pura Vida guys were a great example of that. The Blenders guys were a great example of that. I remember running into the Blenders guys, and they were like, we want to create a sunglass company. And I was like, who cares? You know, like there aren't enough sunglasses. And they were like, well, we just think we know style and da, da, da. And they're just totally immature, right? They didn't even know how immature they are. That's, by the way, that's what I love about undergrads. And I was like, how much money do you have? And they go, we have $1,000 we could scrape together. I go, let's go buy red and black sunglasses in China and sell them on the campus. And then I'm thinking, this is cute, right? So they did that. They pulled their money. They didn't sell very many, but then they sold some later. But long story short, they didn't quit. They eventually sold their 200 or 300 pair. They took that money and they designed something they wanted to sell. Then on their own, without even telling me, they took that freaking design and put it on Indiegogo and raised $26,000. And then they come to me and they go, we have $26,000. And I go, how? Who'd you kill? And they were like, we did an Indiegogo on Photoshop sunglasses. I go, well, do you have them? They go, no. I go, how are you going to deliver them? I go, it takes like somebody's got to build a mold. It's going to take months and months and months to get these built. And they were like, we didn't know any of that. So I helped them again, connected them to somebody else. We bought decent, generic sunglasses, branded them with Blenders, outrageous colors, and they started learning how to sell them online and social media. They never worked for anyone. This naivete, but their willingness to do is what caused Blenders to be purchased last year for $90 million. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. But that's the difference. And by the way, if you would have said to me, where, and this is no ill will to Chase if he watches this, on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you put it? Where would you have put a Chase Fisher on likelihood to succeed as an entrepreneur? Maybe a 2. I have met some amazing people that you meet them and you go, oh man, this is an 8 or a 9, and they don't ever do anything. And then you meet these other people that are just determined. You know, you can't, there's that saying, it's not the size of the dog, the size of the fight in the dog. Sometimes I can't see the size of the fight in a person, in a college type student. I see them, I see their skills, I can look at their vast experience, but I can't see the fight. And the fight is evident when they start to fight. And I never saw it in Chase. You know, here was this guy who was a surfer. He liked to party at rave clubs. He was into electronic music. He was doing not so well at school. You would say, no, 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 no. Wasn't working with startups, didn't know anything about startups, didn't know anything about filing taxes, didn't know anything about building a product. But I never saw the size of the fight in Chase to say, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to be successful or I'm going to die trying. And I'm not going to wish it. I'm going to do something every single day that moves me to building a company. And that's what I would, you know, that's what, when I tell people today that are wishing, I go like, how come you're not selling yet? How come you're not testing? How come you're not? How come you're not? And they have great excuses. And then I kind of walk away going, yeah, I don't think that person's going to make it. Not as an entrepreneur.
That's an amazing story. So, you know, I'd love to give, there's so much more there. And I know that you've worked with, you know, so many amazing entrepreneurs through the year, but let's talk about your books. You know, you've written four or five books. What is the, why do you do that? And what do you hope to accomplish? So you've written.
That's a great question. I never intended to write. I'm a decent writer, short form. You know, I could write great letters. I could write great pitch decks. I could write good proposals. I was a good presenter in front of clients, very passionate, very emotional. I did a TED talk, and the next day I got an email from someone I did not know from New York. And he said, I'd like the PowerPoint of your presentation that you gave yesterday at TED. And I'm like, who the hell is this? So I email him back and I go, first of all, TED doesn't put the talks up for almost 6 weeks until, you know, you've had the talk. No one outside that room has seen that PowerPoint. How do you even know I spoke yesterday? And he emails me back and he goes, I have a friend who saw your TEDx yesterday and he called me and said he thought it was a book. And I am a senior vice president at a publisher in New York and I want your PowerPoint to determine if it's a book. So I'm thinking, okay. So I sent him my PowerPoint. And he goes, yeah, it's possibly a book. If I gave you 13 chapters, could you write one sentence on what you would put in each chapter? So I do that. I've never written a book before. I'm so naive. And then he comes back and he goes, I definitely think it's a book. Could you write a short paragraph of what's contained in each chapter behind that sentence? So I do that. And he goes, this all happened, by the way, in a span of like 4 weeks. He goes, yeah, it's a book. We're going to be sending over a contract. And part of you, your ego side is like, hey, cool. And then once you sign the contract, you're like, oh shit, like I have to write a book. And there's a deadline. And so I did everything wrong in writing the book. So when he got my first draft 6 months later, I didn't hear from him for 2 weeks. This was fail fast. And I finally call him on the phone and I go, you're not giving me any feedback on the manuscript. Like, it's that freaking good, right? And he goes, I'm going to be polite here because we don't know each other that well, but we've gotten to know each other a little bit. I actually like the guy. And he goes, I don't know how to give you feedback. It's so bad. So I was like, I don't know how to respond to that. Can you send me an email? And by chapter, just give me the points of what's not working. So he did that. I printed out the email. It's 6 feet long. And I went through everything. And he's saying things like, get rid of chapter 3, which I think is like a pivot point. And combine 6 and 7. 9 is redundant to 2. Because I didn't write the book in order. I wrote the book whatever I felt like writing that morning. I was a total hippie writer. I'd get up, put music on, whatever I was inspired to write. I would start chapter 6 one day. I would jump into 9 the next day. I would write part of one the day after that. I did everything wrong. And so I was able to use his email and I printed out the manuscript and I was able to, by chapter on the dining table, I was able to compartmentalize everything with email notes from him on chapter 1 and then chapter 1 and go through it. It took me about 2.5 months, but I completely rewrote the book against his notes. And I learned a lot. And so the book was published. About a year later, he comes back and he goes, "What are you doing that's interesting?" I go, "Nothing. I go, I'm just teaching at a university." He goes, "Oh, what are you teaching?" And I go, "Ah, I just started teaching this creativity class." And he goes, "Send me the PowerPoint." So I send the PowerPoint I was using for the creativity class. He's like, "Oh, it's totally a book." And for Simply Brilliant, that was a little more selfish. I was teaching this creativity and innovation course, but I was using about 3 or 4 books from other people. I didn't like everything about any of the books, but I liked pieces of the books. So the selfish part was I wrote the book to be used for people that wanted to be more creative in life, but to be absolutely used in my classroom. And so that's how Simply Brilliant was born. And then I was just frustrated one day, you know him, I was meeting, I'm not going to give you his name, but I was meeting with a young entrepreneur for lunch one day, and I was so frustrated by what he was telling me about marketing and branding and what he was doing with his clients that I literally sat there and said, "What you're doing is just pure bullshit." I go, "You don't even have a clue what you're doing. You're going to kill these brands." I go, "Do you know the difference between branding and bullshit? Because what you're doing is bullshit." And I remember walking away from that lunch going, I wonder how many other young, under 30, only digital marketers know anything about branding. And that's where Brands and Bullshit was born. I wrote it for digital marketers. Startup culture, I told myself after Brands and Bullshit, I wasn't going to write anymore, you know? I got into a conversation one day with a professor at school about culture. She was doing some deep research about why startups fail, you know? And one of her hypotheses was that this cultural aspect, right? That there's a lack of culture, or there's a lack of mission and purpose, which fuels culture or maybe fuels values. And I was listening to what she was saying, and I started thinking about, well, why do startups fail exactly? Is it always, you know, just timing or money or this or that? And I was like, you know, I think some of it might be the intention of the startup, meaning did it have a mission worth being a company? Or was it, I just want to sell socks so I can be rich, you know, which isn't a very good mission. And I remember meeting John Wilson from Stance and him telling me about how freedom and accountability were the mantra at Stance and how it's so hard to get a job at Stance. Like they have like 9 interviews and then with 5 partners, no employee in the company can be hired unless they're interviewed by one of the 5 partners. And I thought to myself, brilliant, that's brilliant. They are so managing the culture because they believe if they line everyone up on the mission, actually first the purpose, then the mission has to align with the values, then that starts to craft the culture. And they only want to bring people in that tribe that fit this culture. And that way they don't have any turnover and they run like hell. And by the way, honestly, I believe that is the number one reason behind Patagonia's success. The leaders there, you know, I think one of the founders is still there. He's like 85. They have never lost that rock in the center of their mission ever. You go back and look at what they might have said in the late 50s, 60s, and 70s when they were nobody and just a little tiny nothing brand. And they said the same thing they're saying today. And I believe they choose their tribe very, very carefully. And that's why if they were a public company, they would be ruined. Because they're private, they manage to that culture, and everything is managed to that culture. Strategic decisions, who they hire, new product lines, everything goes back to the culture. Are we being good to the planet? Are we being kind to our customers? Are we leaving the earth a better place? Are we making a profit? But profit comes last. They don't sacrifice it. They're very profitable. But you know, that's why we pay $240 for a Puff Nano, right?
That's a fantastic story. Well, Bernie, this has been, you know, an amazing conversation. And we so much appreciate, you know, the time that you've spent with us. So thanks so much for joining us.
No, first I appreciate it. I've always had a high respect for you, even though I didn't really know what you did earlier in your career when our daughters were playing soccer together. Then I saw you were at WD-40 and I was like, oh, he's a fellow warrior. And, you know, I think it wasn't that you got more respect for me. I just didn't know who you were. And the more I've come to unravel you, I find you to be a pretty accomplished person.
Thank you.
And that's really cool. And I can tell the humor there is definitely a European humor that's emanating throughout you as well, which is fantastic. And it's delightful to talk with you too.
Yeah, I've never taken myself too seriously. I might be pretty driven. I tell my kids, you have to love what you do. You have to have fun doing what you do. The money comes, the money will follow. But if you can't get up in the morning and either love it or have fun, you can't be there. Life's too short. You just can't be there. And I think I'm still doing that today. I mean, if I wasn't allowed, and I consider it to be a gift, to be at a university and touching minds, the university is, I respect the university for allowing me and kind of honoring me to take, I take it very seriously. You know, what I say to students, how I say to students and what I do. Sometimes it gets me in a little bit of trouble, but my heart's in the right place because I'm brutally honest. My students will tell you that. But I'm still trying to show my students how much fun I'm having in my third, fourth, fifth career. And then I'm trying to set a bar for them to say, you need to have this kind of fun. You know, you need to have this kind of ability to get out of bed in the morning and want to do something so much. It doesn't feel like work. Like I still, in my career, there's only been a couple of times where I felt like I was working.
Those are awesome life lessons. So thank you, Bernie.
All right, thank you.
So from here, what we're going to do is we'll cut some clips from this and have some videos that we'll share with you, and we'll use that to kind of promote our show. We're still probably a month and a half or so away from, you know, kind of posting these podcasts, but what we'll plan to do is we'll send you a few clips when we're ready to go, and we'll tag you when we post. But in the meantime, thanks so much for taking the time. And if you know anyone else that you feel like we should talk with, let us know.
Okay, I will. Are you trying to line 2, 3, 4 of these up so that when you do start releasing them, you can start releasing them every week, like bang, bang, bang?
Yeah, so the plan will be, we won't even post the first one until we've got like 9 or 10 in the bank.
It's a way to do it.
And then our plan would be that we post one a week thereafter. We'll promote each of the first 10 separately, but we want to feel like if someone's taken the time to either look at Spotify to find us or look at our website, we want to have several topics there that they can, you know, dig into.
Yeah, I agree. Because once you post, obviously I'll share it in my network.
Sounds good.
Okay.
All right, Bernie, thanks so much.
It was great, Bernie. And just from Mike and I, who are sort of avid marketers, as you can tell too, loving the stories, truly. The digital fights, the, you know, you can assess an agency a mile away. It's so true, isn't it? So, so true. And I loved your touch points, you know, maximizing, you know, all of us have worked with agencies that just pump that media. And then when you get to the nub of the issue, you realize that the touch points are not necessarily what they see on a television set. Yeah.
So. It's funny because, you know, without realizing it, I'm becoming a little quasi mentor to my kids, which I never set out to be, right? But my daughter in Patagonia, she called me up one day and she was like, what do you say to agency people that you know are bullshitting you? And I go, give me the, for instance. She goes, well, for example, you know, I just got put in charge of this one area of social media and blah, 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 to drive X, to drive Y. It's about a $400,000 spend. And I'm being totally bullshitted by the agency. And she goes, I know I'm being bullshitted because all these other jobs and internships that I did earlier on, I mean, I know what's real and what's not real in Instagram and Facebook and blah, blah, blah. And so I was like, you don't want to publicly embarrass anyone. Ask for a one-on-one with the key account person and just shred that person privately. Just pull them in and say, hey, appreciate you've been working with Patagonia for 2 or 3 years. Let me tell you what's going on now. And I'm doing this as an honest conversation with you to say, if you're going to continue to bullshit me and your agency, you're going to be out because I just got handed this budget and I'm not a power player. I know you've got relationships with other people here, but they're asking me for my recommendations on what we should be doing for a plan. And my plan goes completely against what you guys are doing or suggesting. So do you want to start having honest conversations with me and we can work as a team, or do you want to be out? And she was like, Dad, like,
thank you.
You know, no. She was like, I'm 22. This guy's like 34 and blah, blah, blah. I go, you are not. I go, you are the, when you walk in there, you're not Haley. You are the face of Patagonia. You know, no one cares about Haley, but you better represent Patagonia. And I go, you need to put your Patagonia hat on and go in there like a baller and let this guy know this is not going to stand. But I'm lucid. I'm telling you this calmly. I go, the minute someone gets emotional in a business conversation, it's never going to end well. So no matter what conversations you ever have, don't ever have them until you're calm. And then have them calmly. Say, look, this is business. You know, and they completely shifted. They worked together. She blew up the campaign, brought in like 6 point some million of revenue. They tracked it. And, you know, Patagonia, when they furloughed, she didn't get furloughed. She actually got a promotion. And she's just a puppy there, you know.
Congratulations.
It's not congratulations to Haley exactly. She's still trying to figure it out, Mike. And she doesn't know who she can always turn to trust. Like there was a point in time where she was being undercut by another manager they brought in who was slightly older than her and just wanted to urinate in Haley's space and let her know, hey, I'm the alpha wolf here now. And because Haley didn't report directly to her but was influenced by her in a matrix environment, Haley didn't know how to deal with it. And so I said, I go, here's how you deal with it. I go, you have lunch with her just to find out her background and who she is and this and that and whatever. And it takes balls to have lunch with someone you know is urinating on you. You're going to send a message of calmness to that person. Second, you need to take a step back look at where marketing is going inside Patagonia and then go to your boss and say, I want to become certified in those two areas. I want to get 2 certifications this year. You know, I want to get, you know, Shopify and vertical response because I believe email marketing is going to be big. And I go, and you out-certify and out-expertise this person. And that's exactly what ended up happening. When the shit hit the fan and they had to furlough, they were like, who's a Shopify expert? Who's an email expert? And who understands social media commerce? And it was Haley. But she took 18 months of getting herself there as more of an expert in those areas while the other person was interested in building up political cachet and power. And I told Haley, I go, don't waste your time on that. Get certified in these things, you know, don't waste your time. And so she's learning, she's trying to figure it out. It's not always perfect. But you got to calm these young kids down when they think it's a contest and it's not. I think you said something earlier, it's all about you, right? It's all about, you got to look at yourself as you're the person that you're trying to build over time, not anything else. So you can't piss and moan about things. You got to just make yourself better. And that's what a lot of people get distracted on. They don't make themselves better, that they kind of compete, but they're not building a base underneath that competition. It's not just good enough to compete. You have to build a knowledge and an experience base underneath. And so that's what I'm trying to teach them. So whenever they think, you know, they're being attacked or they're being picked on or somebody doesn't like them, I always force them to step back and say, okay, let's look at the situation from this point of view. Let's remove the politics. Let's remove the jealousy. If you had to remove all of that and you were a partner or a CEO, how would you be evaluating the situation? Or how would you be evaluating which person you wanted to promote in the next year? And then it calms it down and you kind of get a person saying, well, I'm not really good at that. I'm like, is that important, you know, for you to go to the next level? And if it is, then quit worrying about this and focus on that. And usually when you focus on that, it's self-determinant. It's not anything anyone else can control. It's what you can control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Good stuff. Superb. Thank you very much.
Good luck with this. Enjoy the rest of your day.
All right. You take care.
Thank you. We do hope you enjoyed this podcast. And thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.